Reardon stood by Lillian's side and followed her when she moved. She wished to be seen with her husband. He was complying. He did not know whether anyone looked at him or not. He was aware of no one around him, except the person whom he could not permit himself to see. The image still holding his consciousness was the moment when he had entered this room with Lillian and had seen Dagny looking at them. He had looked straight at her, prepared to accept any blow her eyes would choose to give him. Whatever the consequences to Lillian, he would have confessed his adultery publicly, there and in that moment, rather than commit the unspeakable act of evading Dagny's eyes, of closing his face into a coward's blankness, of pretending to her that he did not know the nature of his action. But there had been no blow. He knew every shade of sensation ever reflected in Dagny's face. He had known that she had felt no shock. He had seen nothing but an untouched serenity. Her eyes had moved to his, as if acknowledging the full meaning of this encounter, but looking at him as she would have looked anywhere, as she looked at him in his office or in her bedroom. It had seemed to him that she had stood before them both, at the distance of a few steps, revealed to them as simply and openly as the gray dress revealed her body. She had bowed to them, the courteous movement of her head including them both. He had answered. He had seen Lillian's brief nod. And then he had seen Lillian moving away and realized that he had stood with his head bowed for a long moment. He did not know what Lillian's friends were saying to him or what he was answering. As a man goes step by step, trying not to think of the length of a hopeless road, so he went moment by moment, keeping no imprint of anything in his mind. He heard snatches of Lillian's pleased laughter and a tone of satisfaction in her voice. After a while, he noticed the women around him. They all seemed to resemble Lillian, with the same look of static grooming, with thin eyebrows plucked to a static lift and eyes frozen in a static amusement. He noticed that they were trying to flirt with him and that Lillian watched it as if she were enjoying the hopelessness of their attempts. This, then, he thought, was the happiness of feminine vanity which she had begged him to give her. These were the standards which he did not live by but had to consider. He turned for escape to a group of men. He could not find a single straight statement in the conversation of the men. Whatever subject they seemed to be talking about never seemed to be the subject they were actually discussing. He listened like a foreigner who recognized some of the words, but could not connect them into sentences. A young man with a look of alcoholic insolence staggered past the group and snapped, chuckling, "Learned your lesson, Reardon?" He did not know what the young rat had meant, but everybody else seemed to know it. They looked shocked and secretly pleased. Lillian drifted away from him, as if letting him understand that she did not insist upon his literal attendance. He retreated to a corner of the room where no one would see him or notice the direction of his eyes. Then he permitted himself to look at Dagny. He watched the gray dress, the shifting movement of the soft cloth when she walked, the momentary pauses sculptured by the cloth, the shadows and the light. He saw it as a bluish-gray smoke, held shaped for an instant into a long curve that slanted forward to her knee and back to the tip of her sandal. He knew every facet the light would shape if the smoke were ripped away. He felt a murky, twisting pain. It was jealousy of every man who spoke to her. He had never felt it before, but he felt it here, where everyone had the right to approach her, except himself. Then, as if a single, sudden blow to his brain blasted a moment's shift of perspective, he felt an immense astonishment at what he was doing here and why. He lost, for that moment, all the days and dogmas of his past. His concepts, his problems, his pain were wiped out. He knew only, as from a great clear distance, that man exists for the achievement of his desires. And he wondered why he stood here. He wondered who had the right to demand that he waste a single irreplaceable hour of his life when his only desire was to seize the slender figure in gray and hold her through the length of whatever time there was left for him to exist. In the next moment, he felt the shudder of recapturing his mind. He felt the tight, contemptuous movement of his lips pressed together in token of the words he cried to himself. "You made a contract once. Now stick to it." And then he thought suddenly that in business transactions, The courts of law did not recognize a contract wherein no valuable consideration had been given by one party to the other. He wondered what made him think of it. The thought seemed irrelevant. He did not pursue it. James Taggart saw Lillian Reardon drift casually toward him at the one moment when he chanced to be alone in the dim corner between a potted palm and a window. He stopped and waited to let her approach. He could not guess her purpose, but this was the manner which, in the code he understood, meant that he had better hear her. "How do you like my wedding gift, Jim?" she asked, and laughed at his look of embarrassment. "No, no, don't try to go over the list of things in your apartment, wondering which one the hell it was. It's not in your apartment, it's right here. And it's a non-material gift, darling." He saw the half-hint of a smile on her face. The look understood among his friends as an invitation to share a secret victory. It was the look not of having outthought, but of having outsmarted somebody. He answered cautiously, with a safely pleasant smile, "Your presence is the best gift you could give me."
"My presence, Jim?"
The lines of his face were shock-bound for a moment. He knew what she meant, but he had not expected her to mean it. She smiled openly. "We both know whose presence is the most valuable one for you tonight, and the unexpected one. Didn't you really think of giving me credit for it? I'm surprised at you. I thought you had a genius for recognizing potential friends." He would not commit himself. He kept his voice carefully neutral.
"Have I failed to appreciate your friendship, Lillian?"
"Now, now, darling, you know what I'm talking about. You didn't expect him to come here. You didn't really think that he is afraid of you, did you? But to have the others think he is, that's quite an inestimable advantage, isn't it?"
"I'm surprised, Lillian.
Shouldn't you say impressed? Your guests are quite impressed. I can practically hear them thinking all over the room. Most of them are thinking, if he has to seek terms with Jim Taggart, we'd better toe the line. And a few are thinking, if he's afraid, we'll get away with much more. This is as you want it, of course, and I wouldn't think of spoiling your triumph. But you and I are the only ones who know that you didn't achieve it single-handed."
He did not smile. He asked, his face blank, his voice smooth, but with a carefully measured hint of harshness,
"What's your angle?"
She laughed.
"Essentially the same as yours, Jim, but speaking practically, none at all. It's just a favor I've done you, and I need no favor in return. Don't worry, I'm not lobbying for any special interests. I'm not after squeezing some particular directives out of Mr. Mooch. I'm not even after a diamond tiara from you. Unless, of course, it's a tiara of a non-material order, such as your appreciation."
He looked straight at her for the first time, his eyes narrowed, his face relaxed to the same half-smile as hers, suggesting the expression which, for both of them, meant that they felt at home with each other. An expression of contempt.
"You know that I've always admired you, Lillian, as one of the truly superior women."
"I'm aware of it."
There was the faintest coating of mockery spread like shellac over the smooth notes of her voice. He was studying her insolently.
"You must forgive me if I think that some curiosity is permissible between friends," he said with no tone of apology. "I'm wondering from what angle you contemplate the possibility of certain financial burdens, or losses, which affect your own personal interests."
She shrugged.
"From the angle of a horsewoman, darling. If you had the most powerful horse in the world, you would keep it bridled down to the gate required to carry you in comfort, even though this meant the sacrifice of its full capacity, even though its top speed would never be seen, and its great power would be wasted. You would do it, because if you let the horse go full blast, it would throw you off in no time. However, financial aspects are not my chief concern, nor yours, Jim."
"I did underestimate you," he said slowly.
"Oh, well, that's an error I'm willing to help you correct. I know the sort of problem he presents to you. I know why you're afraid of him, as you have good reason to be. But, well, you're in business and in politics, so I'll try to say it in your language. A businessman says that he can deliver the goods, and a ward healer says that he can deliver the vote, is that right? Well, what I wanted you to know is that I can deliver him any time I choose. You may act accordingly.
In the code of his friends, to reveal any part of oneself was to give a weapon to an enemy. But he signed her confession and matched it when he said,
I wish I were as smart about my sister.
She looked at him without astonishment. She did not find the words irrelevant.
Yes, there's a tough one, she said. No vulnerable point? No weaknesses?
None.
No love affairs?
God, no.
She shrugged in sign of changing the subject. Dagny Taggart was a person on whom she did not care to dwell.
I think I'll let you run along so that you can chat a little with Balfewbank, she said. He looks worried because you haven't looked at him all evening, and he's wondering whether literature will be left without a friend at court.
Lillian, you're wonderful, he said quite spontaneously.
She laughed.
That, my dear, is the non-material tiara I wanted.
The remnant of a smile stayed on her face as she moved through the crowd, a fluid smile that ran softly into the look of tension and boredom worn by all the faces around her. She moved at random, enjoying the sense of being seen, her eggshell satin gown shimmering like heavy cream with the motion of her tall figure. It was the green-blue spark that caught her attention. It flashed an instant under the lights on the wrist of a thin, naked arm. Then she saw the slender body, the gray dress, the fragile, naked shoulders. She stopped. She looked at the bracelet, frowning. Dagny turned at her approach. Among the many things that Lillian resented, the impersonal politeness of Dagny's face was the one she resented most.
What do you think of your brother's marriage, Miss Taggart? She asked casually, smiling.
I have no opinion about it.
Do you mean to say that you don't find it worthy of any thought?
If you wish to be exact, yes, that's what I mean.
Oh, but don't you see any human significance in it?
No.
Don't you think that a person such as your brother's bride does deserve some interest?
Why, no.
I envy you, Miss Taggart. I envy your Olympian detachment. It is, I think, the secret of why lesser mortals can never hope to equal your success in the field of business. They allow their attention to be divided, at least to the extent of acknowledging achievements in other fields.
What achievements are we talking about?
Don't you grant any recognition at all to the women who attain unusual heights of conquest, not in the industrial, but in the human realm?
I don't think that there is such a word as conquest in the human realm.
Oh, but consider, for instance, how hard other women would have had to work, if work were the only means available to them, to achieve what this girl has achieved through the person of your brother.
I don't think she knows the exact nature of what she has achieved.
Reardon saw them together.
He approached. He felt that he had to hear it, no matter what the consequences. He stopped silently beside them. He did not know whether Lillian was aware of his presence. He knew that Dagny was.
Do show a little generosity toward her, Miss Taggart, said Lillian. At least the generosity of attention. You must not despise the women who do not possess your brilliant talent, but who exercise their own particular endowments. Nature always balances her gifts and offers compensations. Don't you think so?
I'm not sure I understand you.
Oh, I'm sure you don't want to hear me become more explicit.
Why, yes, I do. Lillian shrugged angrily. Among the women who were her friends, she would have been understood and stopped long ago. But this was an adversary new to her, a woman who refused to be hurt. She did not care to speak more clearly, but she saw Reardon looking at her. She smiled and said,
Well, consider your sister-in-law, Miss Taggart. What chance did she have to rise in the world?
None, by your exacting standards. She could not have made a successful career in business. She does not possess your unusual mind. Besides, men would have made it impossible for her. They would have found her too attractive. So she took advantage of the fact that men have standards, which unfortunately are not as high as yours. She resorted to talents which, I'm sure, you despise. You have never cared to compete with us lesser women in the sole field of our ambition, in the achievement of power over men.
If you call it power, Mrs. Reardon, then no, I haven't.
She turned to go, but Lillian's voice stopped her.
I would like to believe that you're fully consistent, Miss Taggart, and fully devoid of human frailties. I would like to believe that you've never felt the desire to flatter or to offend anyone. But I see that you expected both Henry and me to be here tonight.
Why, no, I can't say that I did. I had not seen my brother's guest list.
Then why are you wearing that bracelet?
Dagny's eyes moved, deliberately, straight to hers. I always wear it.
Don't you think that's carrying a joke too far?
It was never a joke, Mrs. Reardon.
Then you'll understand me if I say that I'd like you to give that bracelet back to me.
I understand you, but I will not give it back.
Lillian let a moment pass, as if to let them both acknowledge the meaning of their silence. For once, she held Dagny's glance without smiling. What do you expect me to think, Miss Taggart?
Anything you wish.
What is your motive?
You knew my motive when you gave me the bracelet.
Lillian glanced at Reardon. His face was expressionless. She saw no reaction, no hint of intention to help her or stop her. Nothing but an attentiveness that made her feel as if she were standing in a spotlight. Her smile came back as a protective shield, an amused, patronizing smile intended to convert the subject into a drawing-room issue again.
I'm sure, Miss Taggart, that you realize how enormously improper this is.
No.
But surely you know that you are taking a dangerous and ugly risk.
No.
You do not take into consideration the possibility of being misunderstood?
No.
Lillian shook her head in smiling reproach.
Miss Taggart, don't you think that this is a case where one cannot afford to indulge in abstract theory, but must consider practical reality?
Dagny would not smile. I have never understood what is meant by a statement of that kind.
I mean that your attitude may be highly idealistic, as I'm sure it is. But unfortunately, most people do not share your lofty frame of mind, and will misinterpret your action in the one manner which would be most abhorrent to you.
Then the responsibility and the risk will be theirs, not mine.
I admire your... No, I must not say innocence. But shall I say purity? You have never thought of it, I'm sure, but life is not as straight and logical as a railroad track. It is regrettable, but possible, that your high intentions may lead people to suspect things which I'm sure you know to be of a sordid and scandalous nature.
Dagny was looking straight at her.
I don't. But you cannot ignore that possibility.
I do.
Dagny turned to go. Oh, but should you wish to evade a discussion if you have nothing to hide?
Dagny stopped.
And if your brilliant and reckless courage permits you to gamble with your reputation, should you ignore the danger to Mr. Reardon?
Dagny asked slowly. What is the danger to Mr. Reardon?
I'm sure you understand me.
I don't.
Oh, but surely it isn't necessary to be more explicit.
It is. If you wish to continue this discussion.
Lillian's eyes went to Reardon's face, searching for some sign to help her decide whether to continue or to stop. He would not help her. Miss Taggart, she said, I am not your equal in philosophical attitude. I am only an average wife. Please give me that bracelet, if you do not wish me to think what I might think, and what you wouldn't want me to name.
Mrs. Reardon, is this the manner and place in which you choose to suggest that I am sleeping with your husband?
Certainly not.
The cry was immediate. It had a sound of panic and the quality of an automatic reflex, like the jerk of withdrawal of a pickpocket's hand caught in action. She added with an angry, nervous chuckle, in a tone of sarcasm and sincerity that confessed a reluctant admission of her actual opinion, that would be the possibility farthest from my mind.
Then you will please apologize to Miss Taggart, said Reardon.
Dagny caught her breath, cutting off all but the faint echo of a gasp. They both whirled to him. Lillian saw nothing in his face. Dagny saw torture.
It isn't necessary, Hank, she said.
It is, for me, he answered coldly, not looking at her.
He was looking at Lillian in the manner of a command that could not be disobeyed.
Lillian studied his face with mild astonishment, but without anxiety or anger, like a person confronted by a puzzle of no significance.
"But of course,"
she said complacently, her voice smooth and confident again. "Please accept my apology, Miss Taggart, if I gave you the impression that I suspected the existence of a relationship which I would consider improbable for you and, from my knowledge of his inclinations, impossible for my husband." She turned and walked away indifferently, leaving them together, as if in deliberate proof of her words. Dagny stood still, her eyes closed. She was thinking of the night when Lillian had given her the bracelet. He had taken his wife's side then. He had taken hers now. Of the three of them, she was the only one who understood fully what this meant. "Whatever is the worst you may wish to say to me, you will be right." She heard him and opened her eyes. He was looking at her coldly, his face harsh, allowing no sign of pain or apology to suggest a hope of forgiveness. "Dearest, don't torture yourself like that," she said. "I knew that you're married. I've never tried to evade that knowledge. I'm not hurt by it tonight." Her first word was the most violent of the several blows he felt. She had never used that word before. She had never let him hear that particular tone of tenderness. She had never spoken of his marriage in the privacy of their meetings. Yet she spoke of it here with effortless simplicity. She saw the anger in his face, the rebellion against pity, the look of saying to her contemptuously that he had betrayed no torture and needed no help. Then the look of realization that she knew his face as thoroughly as he knew hers. He closed his eyes, inclined his head a little, and he said very quietly, "Thank you." She smiled and turned away from him. James Taggart held an empty champagne glass in his hand and noticed the haste with which Balfe Eubank waved at a passing waiter, as if the waiter were guilty of an unpardonable lapse. Then Eubank completed his sentence.
"But you, Mr. Taggart, would know that a man who lives on a higher plane cannot be understood or appreciated. It's a hopeless struggle trying to obtain support for literature from a world ruled by businessmen. They are nothing but stuffy middle-class vulgarians, or else predatory savages like Reardon." "Jim," said Bertram Scudder, slapping his shoulder, "the best compliment I can pay you is that you're not a real businessman." "You're a man of culture, Jim," said Dr. Pritchett. "You're not an ex-ore digger like Reardon. I don't have to explain to you the crucial need of Washington assistance to higher education."
"You really liked my last novel, Mr. Taggart?" Balfe Eubank kept asking. "You really liked it?"
Orrin Boyle glanced at the group on his way across the room, but did not stop. The glance was sufficient to give him an estimate of the nature of the group's concerns. Fair enough, he thought. One's got to trade something. He knew, but did not care to name just what was being traded.
"We're at the dawn of a new age," said James Taggart from above the rim of his champagne glass. "We are breaking up the vicious tyranny of economic power. We will set men free of the rule of the dollar. We will release our spiritual aims from dependence on the owners of material means. We will liberate our culture from the stranglehold of the profit chasers. We will build a society dedicated to higher ideals, and we will replace the aristocracy of money by the aristocracy of pull," said a voice beyond the group. They whirled around. The man who stood facing them was Francisco D'Anconia. His face looked tanned by a summer sun, and his eyes were the exact color of the sky on the kind of day when he had acquired his tan. His smile suggested a summer morning. The way he wore his formal clothes made the rest of the crowd look as if they were masquerading in borrowed costumes.
"What's the matter?" he asked in the midst of their silence.
"Did I say something that somebody here didn't know?"
"How did you get here?"
was the first thing James Taggart found himself able to utter.
"By plane to Newark, by taxi from there, then by elevator from my suite, 53 floors above you. I didn't mean... that is, what I meant was..."
"Don't look so startled, James. If I land in New York and hear that there's a party going on, I wouldn't miss it, would I? You've always said that I'm just a party hound." The group was watching them.
"I'm delighted to see you, of course," Taggart said cautiously,
then added belligerently to balance it,
"but if you think you're going to—"
Francisco would not pick up the threat. He let Taggart's sentence slide into mid-air and stop, then asked politely, "If I think what?"
"You understand me very well."
"Yes, I do. Shall I tell you what I think?"
"This is hardly the moment for any—"
"I think you should present me to your bride, James. Your manners have never been glued to you too solidly. You always lose them in an emergency. And that's the time when one needs them most." Turning to escort him toward Cheryl, Taggart caught the faint sound that came from Bertram's scudder. It was an unborn chuckle. Taggart knew that the men who had crawled at his feet a moment ago, whose hatred for Francisco d'Anconia was perhaps greater than his own, were enjoying the spectacle nonetheless. The implications of this knowledge were among the things he did not care to name. Francisco bowed to Cheryl and offered his best wishes, as if she were the bride of a royal heir. Watching nervously, Taggart felt relief and a touch of nameless resentment, which, if named, would have told him he wished the occasion deserved the grandeur that Francisco's manner gave it for a moment. He was afraid to remain by Francisco's side, and afraid to let him loose among the guests. He backed a few tentative steps away, but Francisco followed him, smiling. "You didn't think I'd want to miss your wedding, James, when you're my childhood friend and best stockholder?"
"What?"
gasped Taggart, and regretted it. The sound was a confession of panic. Francisco did not seem to take note of it. He said, his voice gaily innocent, "Oh, but of course I know it. I know the stooge behind the stooge, behind every name on the list of the stockholders of D'Anconia Copper. It's surprising how many men by the name of Smith and Gomez are rich enough to own big chunks of the richest corporation in the world. So you can't blame me if I was curious to learn what distinguished persons I actually have among my minority stockholders. I seem to be popular with an astonishing collection of public figures from all over the world, from people's states where you wouldn't think there's any money left at all." Taggart said dryly, frowning,
"There are many reasons, business reasons, why it is sometimes advisable not to make one's investments directly. One reason is that a man doesn't want people to know he's rich. Another is that he doesn't want them to learn how he got that way."
"I don't know what you mean, or why you should object."
"Oh, I don't object at all. I appreciate it.
A great many investors, the old-fashioned sort, dropped me after the San Sebastian mines. It scared them away. But the modern ones had more faith in me and acted as they always do. On faith. I can't tell you how thoroughly I appreciate it." Taggart wished Francisco would not talk so loudly. He wished people would not gather around them.
"You have been doing extremely well," he said, in the safe tone of a business compliment.
"Yes, haven't I? It's wonderful how the stock of D'Anconia Copper has risen within the last year. But I don't think I should be too conceited about it. There's not much competition left in the world. There's no place to invest one's money if one happens to get rich quickly. And here's D'Anconia Copper, the oldest company on earth, the one that's been the safest bet for centuries. Just think of what it managed to survive through the ages. So if you people have decided that it's the best place for your hidden money, that it can't be beaten, that it would take a most unusual kind of man to destroy D'Anconia Copper, you are right."
"Well, I hear it said that you've begun to take your responsibilities seriously, and that you've settled down to business at last. They say you've been working very hard."
"Oh, has anybody noticed that? It was the old-fashioned investors who made it a point to watch what the president of a company was doing. The modern investors don't find knowledge necessary. I don't think they ever looked into my activities." Taggart smiled.
"They look at the ticker tape of the stock exchange. That tells the whole story, doesn't it?"
"Yes. Yes, it does, in the long run."
"I must say I'm glad that you haven't been much of a party hound this past year. The results show in your work."
"Do they?"
"Well, no, not quite yet."